Today on The Grave Talks, Haunted Chicago. Chicago. Just saying the word conjures up various emotions and reactions from people, depending on the connection that you have to the city. For many, it's a city of life, a sprawling metropolis packed to the gills with people of every race, background, origin, and story. It's a city known for its good, just as much as it's known for its bad. It is undoubtedly a city with its ghosts. Chicago is haunted by the spirits of thousands who came before us, the energy of their struggles, their joys, and their lives, still on display in many ways all around the city. On today's episode of The Grave Talks, we talk with John Kashuba, author of Ghost Hunting Illinois. We learn the many spirits that haunt the multiple neighborhoods around Chicago.
Well, I've always been interested in the paranormal, and I grew up in Connecticut, where you hear all these old stories from history and you hear legends and everything else. I've always been interested in that. And early on, I had a chance to meet Ed and Lorraine Warren, who, you know, your audience would probably know. I call them America's godfather and godmother of ghost hunting.
Sure.
But, you know, they're the ones that did the Amityville Horror back in the 70s, mm-hmm. or whenever that was. I don't even remember yep. anymore. But, you know, they've done hundreds and hundreds of investigations around the country. So I had a chance to meet them based on a location in Connecticut that we had both sort of investigated separately without knowing, you know, each other were doing it. And I contacted them because I had some questions about the photos I took there, in which I was seeing what looked like faces appearing in sort of the old cellar holes, basement foundations that were still at this settlement. So they basically were very, you know, kind about helping me. Anyway, they just sort of increased my interest more, and I started thinking about writing about these places, but never really did until I moved out to Ohio. And an editor friend of mine just said, "Hey, you know, you've got a lot of interesting stories here. You ought to write something for us." So that's how this series called America's Haunted Road Trip began. I did the first two books in the series for Ohio and Illinois, and then I also edited several other state books with working with writers in various states. So there's quite a few different states there. But that's how it started. I've always been interested in it, and even when I look at other things that I've written, like short stories or novels that essentially aren't really paranormal, it seems like they're always somewhere in there is a ghost. So they're haunting my work, I guess is what it is, you know.
When you first started writing about the ghost experiences that you had and the stories that would go into the books, what was your understanding at the time of the paranormal? And how has that evolved through your experiences?
I didn't really have an understanding of the paranormal as sort of a cult industry like it is today with TV shows and magazines and, well, you know, websites and everything else, right? I mean, it's extremely popular today. When I went into it, I did this solely as a journalist. I went in with a completely objective viewpoint. I didn't say ghosts existed. I didn't say they weren't. You know, where I wasn't trying to debunk anything, and I wasn't trying to prove anything. I was simply going to locations that had a reported history of haunting, and I would go there and I'd spend as much time as I could there, and I would talk to the people that are there more often. You know, the staff. If it's a hotel, for instance, a haunted hotel, you know, I would talk to the wait staff, the desk clerk, the security guards, the parking attendant, you know, anybody. And I would get their stories. And so I'd record all that, and I'd record anything that happened to me. But I didn't have any, as I said, I didn't have any sort of hidden agenda here. I was simply interested in hearing these stories and reporting on them. And then, you know, later on, as this developed, as my own work developed, I started working more with various paranormal ghost hunting teams, if you will, you know, all around the country. They would contact me and say, you know, we heard about what you're doing, and would you like to join us on a hunt or something? And so I would. So I got more, I guess, involved in what you would call sort of the celebrity aspect of it in a way, you know, and I did some TV and radio and things like that too, based on kind of that. But my whole objective, and my objective still today, is to report on these things as objectively as possible. So to give you an example, I don't own any of the fancy equipment that you see on television with all the different ghost hunting groups. You know, I have a simple camera, I have a simple voice recorder, and dowsing rods, and me, and that's about it. Now, you know, some of the groups that I go with obviously will have steamer trunks full of all kinds of equipment, and that's fine. But as I say, I go in pretty much, you know, just me as sort of my own antenna to see what I can pick up and to see what other people tell me about what's going on.
And I want to jump into the conversation about Illinois and several of the locations that you've put into the book. Before we jump into that, though, mm-hmm. I want to ask you a quick question, and this could have happened anywhere. What was the first experience for you personally where you said, there's something going on here? There's something I can't explain, that this is abnormal, this is paranormal. What was that for you?
I don't know if it was the first experience, but it was certainly one of the most dramatic, probably one of the first that made a real impression on me. And that was in Florida. It was at a house, it's now the Hernando County Historical Society Museum, but it's an old house that was owned by a doctor during the Victorian era. And his wife died in the house giving birth to one of their children. The child was a daughter, and she lived till age 3, and then she succumbed to something. It was either yellow fever or, you know, one of the more common, maybe cholera, one of the common sort of diseases back in the 19th century that, you know, especially was fatal for a lot of either elderly people or children. And so the tragedy there is that, you know, this little 3-year-old girl died. So this place was supposed to be haunted by her, as well as they were seeing the ghost of a soldier there. And one of the things that would happen is the people that would work in the Historical Society would come in the morning. They had these old Victorian toys, like these cast iron toys, and they had them in a sort of display cabinet, a curio cabinet. And they would be put there nicely, and that's where they were, in the cabinet. And if you visited, you'd see them in the cabinet. They would come back in the morning, and they'd find the cabinet open, and they'd find these toys scattered all around the house. They also had a doll that was in a cradle, and they came in one morning, and the cradle had been sort of taken apart and was moved in a different room, and the doll was laying somewhere by it. So they were thinking that this little girl, and for the life of me, I cannot remember what her name was, but they were saying that she was, you know, playing with her toys, and she would leave them like little kids do, and they'd have to go pick up after her. So they asked me to come in and do an investigation there. And I was there overnight with another ghost hunter from a Tampa group. Hernando County is near Tampa. It was myself, him, and the supervisor at this home, at this museum. The three of us were there all night long, and the first thing I noticed when inside was that as soon as we closed the door in this place, it was quiet. Well, yeah, okay, of course it was quiet. It was overnight, there was only three of us there. But I mean, it was a weird quiet. It was a, it's hard to describe it, but it was a very unusual quietness. Right across the street from this place was a biker bar. And if you open the door, you know, there's lights flashing over there, neon lights, and there's all this noise, and there's bikes going up and down the street and everything else. And as soon as you close the door, it was like you were sealing yourself into a vacuum. So that was the first thing I noticed, and actually the other two did too, that they were saying, this is really abnormally quiet. It was a very, very strange atmosphere. But we sat there all night long. We went into the various rooms, we went up into the attic, and we'd sit there in quiet for a while and see if there was anything that would react with us, and nothing happened. So at about 3:00 in the morning, we decided, you know, this is a bust. Nothing's going on. And the supervisor was all apologetic. She said, I can't believe this. We have action here all the time. There's always activity. Now I invite you here, nothing happens. So we decide, okay, that's it. We're going to leave. So this place had an alarm system. So I set all the alarms, and then we had to leave through the rear exit, which is through a kitchen. And the kitchen was set up, again, in Victorian era style. So there was you know, there were different kinds of appliances and cabinetry and all from that time. And one thing, there was a wood burning stove that was in the room, sort of by the door. And if you've ever seen a wood burning stove, this one, it's an old fashioned one. So it was like a big cast iron, almost like a potbelly stove, but the top was flat and it had a round metal plate on the top of it with an eye bolt. And attached to that eye bolt was an iron rod, probably 18 inches long, and it probably weighed about 10 ounces or something like that, half a pound to 10 ounces. So it was a pretty solid iron rod. And what you would do is that furnace would get really hot, so you couldn't touch it, but you would grab this rod, you'd lift up that plate, and you'd throw more wood in, and then you'd slam it down again. So that was function. And the rod was laying completely across the surface of the stove. As we walked by, the three of us walked by, we had one flashlight. And as we're walking by, we notice in our peripheral vision of the flashlight, we can see that this rod suddenly rises up and it flips over. So this is an 18-inch metal rod that rises up on its own and it flips over, does a 180, and it slams itself down on the top of that lid. It goes bam. And it hits so hard that it actually popped off the eye bolt that was attached to and fell on the floor. So the three of us sat there and we stood there and we said, holy cow, which is typically what you say when you see something like that, because we were totally stunned by this. Here we had put everything away, cameras were away, everything was done. We're walking out, everything, all our instrumentation is packed up, and that thing happens just by the back door as we're about to leave. And it was, you know, we stopped there and we picked that rod up and we played around with it. We said, is there any way that we could have moved that or somehow knocked it over? There was nothing. So it defied all the laws of physics. You know, when you see something like that, it's completely unexplainable by any natural law that we know of today.
Sure.
So that's a paranormal means, right? Something mm-hmm. out of the normal, something that cannot be accounted for. So that was, I would say, probably my first significant paranormal event. I mean, I certainly will remember that.
Let's jump over to Illinois, and let's first tackle talking about Chicago. There's several pieces of Chicago that I know I have some questions about, but before I get to those, I'd love for you just to kind of tell me, you know, when you began looking into the city of Chicago. Obviously, there are so many hauntings mm-hmm. there, but of what you've researched and what you studied about, what are some of them that really stood out to you? What to you was the one that you just go, this is quite an amazing story? I know they all are somewhat, but to you personally, what one spoke to you the most?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I need to back up before I even go into what I saw or the experiences that I had or the places I went to okay. talk briefly about the East Lake disaster.
Okay.
Because this happened in Chicago yeah. in 1915.
Yeah.
And basically it was a steamer that was at a pier in the Chicago River, less than 20 feet of water, within, you know, walking distance, attached to sidewalks and everything else. And it was being loaded up for an outing by a company. They were going to take all these people out to some island. They were going to have a nice, you know, kind of outing in the summer. This is 1915. And for whatever reason, and it's still, I think, kind of unknown, as people are getting on the ship, the steamer started listing to one side. And they tried to right it by changing the ballast, shifting it over, and so it started listing to the other side. They couldn't get it right. And before you know it, this ship, just literally lays over on its side in the Chicago River. Now, it was loaded with people. Over 1,000 people were on this ship. And they couldn't get out. Many of them were below deck, trapped below deck. And again, this is like the early 1900s, 1915. So, you know, women are wearing these, you know, long dresses and heavy clothes and shoes, and the men are wearing suits and all this kind of stuff. Not easy things to, you know, get out of when you're in water. But this is 20 feet of water, which is really nothing when you think about it. But 844 people drowned in that in that event. 22 entire families wiped out. It was an amazing event, and here it happens right in downtown Chicago. You know, not on the ocean. It wasn't that Titanic. In a sunny day, right at its pier on the Chicago River. it took a while to extricate all the bodies. Police and rescue workers had to cut through the hole and everything else, the exposed side, and really drag people out. But they took them to what was then a National Guard armory. And today, that armory is part of Oprah Winfrey's Harpo Studios. And they also took them to what was the Historical Society, which, at least when I was there, was the nightclub Excalibur. And I don't know if that nightclub is still around or not. I can't vouch for that, but it was when I was writing the book. But in these two locations, people have said that they have seen spirits there. They've seen ghosts. They've seen people dressed in Victorian clothing. A very famous one that supposedly happened in Harpo Studios, although I have, you know, yet to confirm that with anybody at Harpo because nobody would talk to me about it. But supposedly on security camera, they captured something they call the Gray Lady, which is a woman in Victorian clothing that you see sort of moving down the hallway. And children have been seen and heard at the Excalibur, the nightclub, along with a man in a white tuxedo, apparently. So they have all these ghosts, and it makes sense. You know, 844 people, like, it's wiped out like that. So that's pretty amazing. So right there in Chicago, you got that going.
That's one of those disasters that I think so many people, if you're interested in maritime disasters, is overlooked sometimes or not even known about because it's not one of those out on the seas. It was literally in downtown Chicago. I remember the first time I learned about it, I was like, oh my God. And it was kind of funny because I had just that previous week been in Chicago, right down by the area where this had happened, and I had no idea that had happened in that precise area. But just a shocking thing. I believe it was one of the worst maritime disasters, if not the worst, following Titanic. I know Titanic killed more people, but up until that point, right, I believe it was like, this is like second at that point in time.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it might be, I'm not certain, but I think it might be the most significant American maritime disaster, you know, possibly. But yeah, it was incredible. And as you say, it's right within, if you see old photos, I had some archival photos, and I actually have some in the book, Ghost Hunting Illinois. I mean, the sidewalks and the buildings are almost within touching distance from the ship. You know, it's right there. It's in its berth. It's tied up to a wharf, you know, and it's incredible that it just happens like that. And like I said, it was less than 20 feet of water, you know, so it's just a horrible thing, but amazing too. So there are a couple of places that I visited, and one place that I thought was pretty interesting was a place called the Red Lion Pub, and this was downtown. I don't have, unfortunately, I'm not looking at a book right now in front of me, so I don't know the exact address, but it was right downtown. And what I liked about this was the idea that there's a couple of different things happening. The Red Lion Pub was founded by an Englishman named John Cordwell, who served in the RAF during World War II and actually was a POW and escaped and everything else. He had his own quite colorful history. His son now is the proprietor of it. When I went to visit them, I'd heard some inklings about something going on there. And the first thing that his son showed me was a photo that they had taken of patrons at the bar. There were a couple of women, a couple of men, and they were just, you know, smiling for the camera and everything else. And in the background is his father, John Cordwell, which, you know, wouldn't be remarkable except that, you know, his father had died several years previous to that photo being taken. I saw the photo and, you know, it's a little misty, but it sure looks like he showed me another photo of his father, and it sure looked like his father in this photo. So apparently his father is still, you know, tending bar there and seeing over his patrons. But there's some interesting things also that happen there. And on the second floor, according to his son, there had been a fire at one point before this place was a bar, and they weren't sure so much about who the woman was, but a woman died in that fire, and they thought that she may have been a woman that had some, you know, psychological issues and probably wasn't in her right mind and didn't know how to get out of a burning building or, you know, wasn't capable of doing it. In any case, she apparently passed away. So now on the second floor, which is also part of the bar, they'll hear footsteps a lot back and forth on the floor, and they'll go up there to check, and of course they won't find anybody up there. One time when they went there, they heard somebody walking around up there, so they went upstairs to check it out, and they didn't find anybody out there, but one of the bar stools was turned upside down, completely upside down on the floor, and its wheels were spinning as if somebody had just jumped off the bar stool and turned it upside down and, you know, spun the wheels or something. But, you know, that was going on, so they didn't know what to make of that. But they also have had some possible sightings of this this woman. Some of the female patrons have, at least one in particular, made a remark about, and this is a quote from her, "a chick in a nightgown," she said, "who is in the ladies' room." And apparently she said that, you know, she was kind of strange and she didn't know what was going on and that she seemed to be sort of out of it. So this woman asked somebody to, you know, go in and check. And one of the women, I guess, at the bar went in to check the ladies' room to see this chick in a nightgown. And of course, there was nobody there. And there is no other way out of the ladies' room. You know, it's got one door in and out. And another time in the same ladies' room, they heard somebody screaming. It was a woman that was screaming. And so they went to run to the door and see what's going on and everything else because they heard her screaming and pounding on the door, and they couldn't get the door open. It seemed like it was locked. So they called the police. They said, you know, we got somebody here. We got somebody screaming in the ladies' room and the door is locked. We don't know what's going on. The police come in. They break down the door and there's no one there. So I found this to be really a very interesting place. We don't know who that is. We don't know if it's this young woman that died in the fire many years ago who is this female ghost, or if there's somebody else there. We don't know. And we also think that John Cordwell is still there too, the father of the guy who founded the bars, maybe still watching out for it. So that was kind of an interesting place. And it's right across the street, by the way, from the Biograph Theater, mm-hmm. which is where John Dillinger was shot and killed as he was leaving the Biograph. And people say, too, that they see Dillinger on the sidewalk, that supposedly his ghost has been seen on the sidewalk, actually getting shot, falling to the ground or staggering down the sidewalk. So it's kind of interesting that you may have these two things going on possibly the same street there.
Sure. What I find interesting about the stories of Dillinger or Capone or anything like that, because I grew up in Wisconsin along the route that they would take to their hideout up in Wisconsin. And it's funny, almost every bar, every location from that era that still stands to this day, that is still in operation. So many of them have their gangster stories. Of you know, this mm-hmm. place is haunted and it's Dillinger or it's Capone or this or that. I have one of the one of the old signs from one of the locations that would have been actually standing in the era of where they would have stopped there. It's from a place called Club Harbor, close to where I grew up in Wisconsin. And I have the part that says Food and Cocktails, the big porcelain sign. And it's a neat piece of history. And I joked with my wife. I said, now that we have this, now we're going to have the ghost of Dillinger in, although they play it up as Capones these days. But we're going to have one of them hanging out in our bar in our house or something. But
you will.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's funny. I investigated a place called Widow McCleary's Bar and Grill. This was in Thornton, Illinois, outside of Chicago. And they have a Capone story there too. Mm-hmm. But this place is interesting because it's haunted. The story was that the man that owned this, it was a brewery originally owned by a guy named McCleary. Mm-hmm. And the story goes that Capone wanted his brewery to use for, you know, his bootlegging operations or whatever. And that he approached McCleary. And he said, hey, you know, let's go into business together on this. I'll make you a rich man and all that. But McCleary, unfortunately, was an honest person and said, you know, I don't want anything to do with it. So there was a fire, oddly enough, and McCleary dies in the fire. What a surprise. So apparently, by the story, Al Capone then ends up using this place as some kind of a, you know, either just a hideout or a place for storage for his, you know, bootlegging operation or whatever. But that's what he used. There's a rumor, and this has not been confirmed at all, but that during renovations in this building many, many years later, after, you know, in the 50s, I guess, or maybe even the 60s, and supposedly the remains of 10 bodies were found in the basement and then just reburied, you know, somewhere else. But if that's the case, we're saying, well, now, who were those bodies? They could have been people from the fire, but that fire was, if I'm back in the 20s, the Capone days, so, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, maybe 40 years later, we're finding bodies there. So part of the legend is that if Capone was using this place, he may have also been using it to, you know, bump off some of his competitors, and maybe that's who they found in the basement.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, though, this place is supposed to have a ghost, and they think the ghost is, again, it's funny, again, it's a little girl that they see primarily, but it's the Widow McCleary, they believe, and maybe her daughter. So what happens is a lot of times they hear, hear like whispering, you know, even when it's very quiet, like there's maybe only one or two patrons, they'll hear whispering that's coming from the bar as if somebody's there. But, you know, of course, they'll go closer to the bar and there's nobody there. And sometimes they get like this bright flash of light, which they don't know what that's about either. It'll just kind of appear. But what I thought was really interesting was that on the second floor, they have a billiard table up there. And they say that the little girl, who is, I guess, McCleary's daughter, is up there and she'll play with the billiard balls. And I said, oh, really? Okay. So I went up there with the people and they, they took a cue ball, I guess, actually off the billiard table and they put it on the floor. And we stood there for a while. And one of the waitresses called out to the little girl and said, hey, you know, if you're here, you know what, let's play ball. Why don't you roll this ball? And that ball started to move. And I'm standing about 12 feet away from it. And it starts rolling across the floor. It's a hardwood floor. It starts rolling across the floor very slowly, right up to me, right? And then it stops. Okay, now I have a house. I live in a house that's about 97 years old. And we have hardwood floors. They squeak. They groan. They're at every kind of angle you can possibly imagine. None of them are level. So if I put a marble or a ball down on one of my floors, I know it's going to roll. But this one rolled to me, stopped, and then, after a complete stop, started to roll again. And it rolled in a circle around me as I stood there. This thing rolled around a circle and went back to where it was again and stopped. And then rolled off like to the edge of the room. I said, holy cow. You know, I mean, that again, talking about defying logic. So of course, I grabbed that billiard ball. I say, okay, you know, we have a weight in here, or what is this? Nah, it was just a solid billiard ball. I mean, I could see nothing, you know, that was, I couldn't see anything that said, okay, this ball has been, you know, tampered with or whatever. So I don't know how that happened. But they, you know, the waitress said, well, yeah, you know, she's just playing with you. You know, she was here, and that's what she does when we ask it to us. Okay, so there's a little girl that plays with the billiard balls up there, I guess.
That's amazing. Chicago has a lot of cemeteries, and obviously one of the more famous, yes, that we know about in pop culture, if you will, would be Resurrection Cemetery and Resurrection Mary. But there are several others as well that have their fair share of activity. I know in the book you wrote about Graceland Cemetery. You want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, now China, and I'm trying to be honest, I'm trying to remember Graceland. I think that, I don't have the book in front of me, I'm thinking that is the one that has the statue of a little girl in a glass case.
Yes.
And I can't think of her name. Okay. So the story is that this little girl and her family were out picnicking, and you know, when cemeteries, some of those beautiful park cemeteries were first built, they were treated as parks. And people would go picnic there on a Sunday and everything else. I live in Cincinnati, and we have a beautiful old National Historic Museum called Spring Grove. And it's not uncommon on any Sunday or weekend to see bridal parties there, getting pictures taken by the fountains and the trees, and people do picnic there. So some people are still using the cemeteries like that. But this little girl was with her family, and there was a storm that came up, and she was struck by lightning and she was killed. And the statue of her is a beautiful statue. She's sitting in a chair. If I recollect, I don't know if she has a toy with her or there's a dog at her feet. I'm not sure. I don't recall exactly. But she's sitting in this chair, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful sculpture of this little girl. And it's in a glass box. It's in a completely glass box. And the story is that during lightning storms, you know, thunderstorms that come up, that if you check the cemetery there, you'll find that she's missing from that box. She disappears. And then apparently reappears again once the storms have passed. And, you know, again, I wasn't there during a storm, so I can't verify that. But it would make sense to me that if you were struck by lightning as a child, that as a ghost, you might also fear lightning and a lightning storm and might want to seek shelter somewhere else outside of a glass box. So, you know, that's possible.
Yeah. That wraps up part one of our interview about haunted Chicago. In part two of our interview exclusively for Gravekeepers, we'll discuss several other iconic Chicago locations that are known for their ghosts, including the Museum of Science and Industry, the ghost of Bachelor's Grove Cemetery. We also discuss if the geography of Chicago may play a role in it being such a haunted city, and we'll take a trip outside of Chicago to Springfield, Illinois, to discuss the ghost of Abraham Lincoln in his hometown. To hear part two of our interview, become a Gravekeeper on our website at thegravetalks.com or through patreon.com/thegravetalks. The link is there at thegravetalks.com. You'll get access to every episode of our show commercial-free months before they go public. Also, access to our exclusive part two interviews that are always exclusive to Gravekeepers only. Also have access to submit questions to upcoming guests of our show and the good feeling of knowing you're keeping this program on the air. It's only $5 a month to be a Gravekeeper. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. That's patreon.com/thegravetalks. patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.